Have you registered for the upcoming live summit in London yet? If not, what are you waiting for? Imagine spending 2 days in person sharing ideas with the very people you've heard on this podcast. The tactics, strategies, and actionable insights that you'll take away are incredible. One of our repeat guests and Pinnacle Society members, Rich Rosen, attended a previous live summit, and he told us that he added $100,000 in additional revenue within just 45 days of attending from one strategy that he took away. Now, keep in mind, it was a strategy he was already aware of, and he knew he should be doing it. He just wasn't doing it. Have you ever been there? Can you relate to that? What made the difference was getting a detailed playbook he could implement, plus hearing from multiple recruitment business owners who had already successfully implemented that same strategy. That's what tipped him over the edge into action. If this sounds like something you could benefit from, then visit recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Hey, resilient recruiters, here's reason number two why you must attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. And that is the keynote presentations. You'll gain exclusive insights from other top billing recruiters and entrepreneurs who've either scaled their own desk or built multi-seven-figure businesses. I myself will, of course, be one of the speakers, but the presentations that I am the most excited about are not professional speakers and trainers, but other recruitment business owners like you who will be unpacking their most effective tactics and strategies. No theory, just practical insights from people who are in the trenches, ordinary people achieving extraordinary results. There's still time to take advantage of the early bird pricing. By the way, it's happening on September 17th and 18th. So don't miss out. Reserve your place now at recruitmentcoach.com/summit.
We all have our motivators. We all have our reasons why we choose to get into recruitment, why we stay in recruitment, and they vary from person to person. But for me, if you aren't connected to the purpose of what you're doing, then I think over time, those motivators could fade and then recruitment becomes even harder.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by Anthony Lewis.
You know, you've got generational differences about your willingness to pick up a phone and spend time on a phone. I was born in an environment of you just phone. And I think, well, yeah, hold on, surely we should be doing more of that. Let's pick up the phone. Let's get our time up. But actually, if we're dealing with a client and candidate base that also don't want to be on the phone, then we're not playing to their kind of advantage and that kind of interest.
Anthony is the managing director at Tile Hill, a public sector focused executive recruitment company.
For me, it's about placing people into public sector organizations that are influencing the world that we all exist in, you know, the society, the fabric of it, you know, our ability to go out our front door and for our bins to be collected, for the train to be at the station, all of those things that these people are at the forefront of making happen.
Tile Hill has been awarded the best company to work for, the best in-house L&D at the 2024 REC Awards, the best candidate experience category. They've also most recently been voted the number one interim service provider by the Institute of Interim Management.
I don't want anyone in our business to not know where their career can take them, the journey they need to go on, the skills they need to gain, the skills they need to develop, and how we're going to support them to do that. And that doesn't mean we shy away from difficult conversations around perhaps where the deficit is, but it should be from a place of, let's try and tackle that with you. You know, if this is where you want to try and get to, let's support that. And we will invest in the training that goes with that.
Anthony's passionate about the careers of public sector leaders and supporting organizations nationally to attract and hire the best talent, and he's done so for over a decade. Anthony, welcome. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. So we found you on LinkedIn, and because of all the awards that you guys are winning, which is pretty cool, but take me back like to the beginning of your career. How did you get into recruiting in the first place?
So I'm one of those rare beasts that chose recruitment as a career. I didn't fall into it. It was purposeful. It started on a university undergraduate placement. I was working for an HR consultancy, was in a very office orientated role, which I was enjoying, but I got the opportunity to go and shadow part of the business that did interim recruitment. And I spent a week where I was meeting people for lunch and going for coffees and occasionally having some phone calls for people. And I was like, hold on, is this work? if this is work, I'm in. So went back and finished my degree. And at that point in time, that company I'd worked for wasn't the right one to join for me. But I went to start at Michael Page on the grad scheme, did 2 years with them. And, you know, the foundational learnings and the culture and the atmosphere to which you kind of get thrust into there was an absolute brilliant starting point to my career. And yeah, I think has laid the foundations for success beyond that, but also is probably the polar extreme of actually kind of what I think is important in recruitment now. So whilst I'm grateful and thankful for that time, actually, I think the world's moved on since then. And not being in that business, I can't talk to you about how that is now. But that took me from working for law firms where I was placing part qualified accountants to actually then re-engaging back into that business. I did my undergraduate placement with a company called Penner, and I went to join them in their interim practice to do public sector interim, so local authorities predominantly, a world I didn't know anything about, a seniority that I wasn't used to working with. And I had all sorts of inner demons about that move, you know, the ability to apply the kind of the expertise I had as a recruiter, but into a completely different setting and where typically I was interacting with much more senior people. But I never looked back. I loved it. I kind of fell in love with the sector I was working with. I fell in love with the people that I got to support, really enjoyed the kind of the colleagues I had around me at the time. And we had a really exciting growth journey. You know, we went from a relatively new provider in that market to being one of the leading companies in that space. But as happens, things changed and Penner was acquired by the Adecco Group. And I'd never seen my career growing within a multinational FTSE company. It was one of the reasons that I didn't see my career in Michael Page growing beyond the level I got to. I've always wanted to do something where I have a little bit more entrepreneurialism, have the ability to create, shape and mold something. And so after a while, as that merger took place, I realized actually my future lay elsewhere, and had kept in contact with the guy, David Weir, who had brought me back to Penner. He had since then founded Tal Hill. And we, yeah, agreed to go on this journey. And the last 6 years has absolutely flown by, and I'm enormously proud of what we're building as a business. But the bit that's most exciting with that is that we're only just getting started. So you've listed some of these awards that we're humbled by, and we're really grateful to have received. But we know there's a lot more we can do.
Awesome. All right, that's a great overview. And yeah. Michael Page is a great training ground, right? I've had quite a few guests who started out there. Do you know Leo Hewitt by any chance?
I can't say I do, I'm afraid.
All right. You should know him. He's been a former guest on the podcast. He's actually speaking at our upcoming live summit in London, set up his own business. Very, very different, which is like purpose led. They're a B Corp, and they're doing phenomenally well over there. I don't think they do public sector, so there's. I'm sure you'd enjoy connecting with him. I'll make an introduction. So before we dive in, I want to focus mainly on the entrepreneurial journey over the last six years, and you know how you guys have won so many awards, and you know what how some of the ways you guys are differentiating. Before we do that, could you just explain to me in simple terms, just so that I and the listeners understand, when you say public sector leadership, like what sort of roles are you placing people into, and in what organizations are we talking about? Local government, or like what exactly is your client base?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, indulge me here. So this is where hopefully some passion will come through, but we are privileged to stand alongside people that are shaping the society that we all live in. So we get to support the most amazing people that are drawn to working in public sector organizations that have the intellectual capability to do whatever it is they choose to, but have, for whatever reason, chosen to pursue a career in public service. So that sees us working with chief execs, directors, board level professionals who are working across central government, the not-for-profit sector, so civil society, housing associations, local authorities, and kind of we dabble a little bit within health and education. But I'd say our core areas are around, local authorities, government and civil society and housing. That sees us kind of work with a range of professional disciplines, so non-execs, chairs, chief execs, and then anything you'd expect to see at C-suite. We specialize within each of those sectors. We have people that specialize in professional verticals as well. I think increasingly the world that we are in, candidates are highly discerning, candidates are in relatively short supply. And if you really want to understand people's career objectives, their career motivations, and to be able to advocate them in the way that I think is important, you need to immerse yourself in that candidate network. And a few years back, I used to go out and I'd try and demonstrate that I had a network of professionals across every professional discipline, across multiple sectors. And whilst I had some, it was surface level. And as we've embedded this model, we've realized the scale of opportunity that exists within that and the ability to take people on career journeys. In the 6 years that I've been with Tile Hill, the 8 years it's been going, we place people into not just one role, but two roles, three roles. We've been able to support them in that career growth. And there's something really, really fulfilling to me. The purpose of what we do is about supporting people's careers. And there's something really awesome about the ability to do that and not just on a one-off basis. So that's a bit of an overview. We'll see if you ever come to our website.
So I got a hint of it there, but what... You're obviously passionate about this particular public sector. What is it about that sector that you feel like is aligned with what you want to do for a living?
So for me, it's purpose. So I don't think that is purely aligned to working with public sector organizations. That just happens to be for me and the people that have chosen to work with us, the calling. But I think recruitment is an incredibly difficult job. Those of us that have worked in recruitment, we've had good days, bad days. You have to be able to stand up to fairly enormous amounts of rejection, and the learning curves that you go on are huge. We all have our motivators. We all have our reasons why we choose to get into recruitment, why we stay in recruitment, and they vary from person to person. But for me, if you aren't connected to the purpose of what you're doing, then I think over time, those motivators could fade and then recruitment becomes even harder. So yes, there's a financial element to what we do. That's, there aren't many careers, I don't think, that actually can allow you to earn as quickly as you do within recruitment. And I think that's worth celebrating. But there aren't many careers as well where you can have such a positive impact on people on a daily basis. Every interaction you have with someone could set them on a journey, and you may not realize it at the time. And it always hits me really hard when I might be speaking to someone and they'll say, "You'll never remember, Anthony, but you once said this one thing to me and it changed things." And that's a privilege. That's a responsibility that I think we can sometimes overlook. And I think if we're not connected to purpose, recruitment then becomes very much about chasing of a fee. It becomes a transaction. And then I think our customers start to feel that. And I think that's what starts to give recruitment a bad name in place, is because actually we're commoditizing people's career choices. And that for me is something that if we lose sight of the purpose, and for me, it's about placing people into public sector organizations that are influencing the world that we all exist in, the society, the fabric of it, our ability to go out our front door and for our bins to be collected, for the train to be at the station, all of those things that these people are at the forefront of making happen. That's awesome. We can't take credit for the fact that these things are happening, but we can stand alongside these people to help them get these jobs that fulfill their career purpose and give them enormous sense of well-being and pride. So for us, that's our calling, our purpose. And it's what excites me every single day when I get up, is the ability to do that and the ability to work alongside people that share that purpose, share that mission, and are really excited by it.
Excellent answer. I love that. That's cool. So I want to get into the growth journey at Tile Hill and, some of the ups and downs and learnings that have come out of that. But just so I have the context, so Can you give me an idea of the sort of size and shape of the business as it stands today?
Yep. So we employ just under 50 people. We have a board practice, an interim practice, and then we have our executive search practice. We've been going for, as I say, about 8 years. We've been fortunate to achieve year-on-year growth, and that's both in terms of headcount, net fee income, profit. And within that, I think we've been able to really start to embed the structures that allow us to have the platform and the environment. And we talk a lot about an environment for success. And we've invested heavily in making sure we've got the conditions that allow people to join Tile Hill and be successful. So whether that are people that are at the beginning of their recruitment career, so straight out of school, straight out of uni, through to those that join us with 20, 25 years of experience, and to give them access to the tools, but also then the environment, the mindset, and colleagues that allow them to be better than they thought they were capable of and to achieve things that they perhaps didn't think were possible. Central to that is investment in L&D. We've always made clear that for us, we want our teams to have really clear career paths. I don't want anyone in our business to not know where their career can take them, the journey they need to go on, the skills they need to gain, the skills they need to develop, and how we're going to support them to do that. And that doesn't mean we shy away from difficult conversations around perhaps where the deficit is, but it should be from a place of, let's try and tackle that with you. You know, if this is where you want to try and get to, let's support that. And we will invest in the training that goes with that. I can expand on that if that's helpful at this point.
Or yeah, I'd love to. I think because one of the things that is very clear from the way you're speaking as well as the awards you've won is you believe that L&D is central to the success of your team and therefore the business. So could you share more detail around the career path and then the L&D that supports that?
So we've got different career paths and career journeys. So depending on the role that you're in currently, where you see yourself going, we've got fee earning, non-fee earning, operational roles, we've got marketing, but we put equal importance on the career journeys of everyone. So for us, there is no hierarchy of fee earners over anyone else. We're all part of a team. None of us can achieve what we need to achieve without the support of others and the expertise of others. So we have a range of training mechanisms. We have a core program that we agree on a 12-month basis. So we've got a training partner that we work with, Arden Matheson. We sit down with our leadership group, understanding what their teams need for them to grow in the way that they're building into their business plan. We then look at what are the training interventions that follow through from that, and we then structure that and put groups of people into it. So whether that's management training, billing management, through to needs-based selling, negotiating, we're spending a fair bit of time at the moment talking about sales psychology, and how you actually get yourself into the right mindset to have the right conversations with people. Some of it is around insights and just understanding who we are. And one of the things that sits central in our business is kind of empathy and cultural intelligence. We want people to understand how to get the best out of each other, how to interact with those that they're dealing with. And I think emotional and cultural intelligence is central to that. So we spend a lot of time thinking about that. That's core. Outside of that, we invest around inclusion. So having an inclusive business is fundamental for us, but actually making sure we are at the forefront of understanding what EDI is around. And so we invest with an inclusion partner that supports us around training. We've just about to conclude an 18-month leadership development program. So our top team, second 9 people, will all of it benefited from an 18-month program. Key to success is the ability of our leadership team to work with those around them, and we've got a really strong principle around leadership. And for us, we don't look at that just at those that are the best billers. We don't just look at those that are the best sales professionals. We look at those that actually have the ability to lead those around them to, again, achieve more than they think is possible and to really inspire them. As I say, recruitment is a hard job. You've got to break down barriers on a daily basis. And if you can't understand why you're doing that and you haven't got connection to the vision, alignment to the team purpose, alignment to the values of the business, then I think that becomes even harder. And it's down to our leadership team to create that environment to get people connected into it.
Okay, awesome. So yeah, this is a mistake I think a lot of recruitment companies make, is that distinction between promoting your best billers versus the ones with leadership potential. And there's obviously an overlap there in the Venn diagram, but they're not synonymous, right? And that can lead to all kinds of problems, which we've both probably seen firsthand. But so I understand that there's not a hierarchy of fee earners over operations or marketing or what have you, but I'm guessing that fee earners make up the largest number of employees. And since most of our listeners are fee earners, then just focusing on that for the time being, if someone joins you, well, first of all, do you hire experienced or inexperienced recruiters or a mixture of both?
We hire a mixture of both. Yeah, it's contingent on the role, the need of that market. But yeah, we're open.
Okay, fantastic. And then how does the training differ in each of those cases?
Regardless of your level of experience, you will immediately be placed into a training program. And by immediately, I don't mean on day one, but we want everyone to have a baseline of understanding and training. So depending on the seniority or the level that you come in with, will determine kind of what is the catch-up program that we run, and what is it that we feel is needed. And some of that is self-led as well. So one of the kind of central themes that we talk about a lot is curiosity. So growth mindset and curiosity for me go hand in hand. We want to attract people to the business that are aware of the idea that they don't know everything, and by no means are they finished articles. So whether you've got a year's experience or 25 years experience, maybe longer, you might be brilliant, but there is always stuff that you can learn. There's always stuff that you can know. And internal kind of performance conversations are always centered around where are you today versus where you want to get to. What are the skills that you need to develop and deploy, and how do we support you to do that? And that's self-led, because I could tell you to get better at something, but if you haven't come to the table saying that, then you're going to pay lip service to it. So in those early days, we'll have conversations with people about where they are, where they think they need to grow, and we'll then make sure that the training support sits around that. If you're joining us completely cold, we don't have a title of learning academy or anything like that, but we have a really curated program that starts with your onboarding, that starts with your first 2 weeks in the business and how you're introduced into it, and then the way that we kind of drip you into various elements of the role. But theory of recruitment, the theory of what we're doing sits alongside that. I think we're also really... we're passionate about nurturing and developing the future talent of recruitment. And we can point to really great success stories of people in our leadership team that joined in what we call an associate consultant role. So that is essentially a candidate facing role where you are supporting in the development of a candidate network. You are learning the basics of recruitment. The risk with that role is you wait for the perfect condition for that person to be ready to take on the client facing element of the job. And through learning, I've realized there is never the perfect condition for that to happen. At some point, you've got to be thrust into a different scenario, and you learn. You learn through failure. You learn through kind of getting things wrong. And actually, one thing I take from Michael Page is you are on day one put on the phone. You are made to pick up that phone, and they're comfortable with you making mistakes. But what they're also very sometimes kind of blunt about is, you know, go and correct that mistake. So you didn't ask that question, phone them back and ask it. And you learn that very quickly. Now, that's not how we do things now, but we definitely have a culture of psychological safety where actually we want people to go and learn. And if we try and create this perfect vacuum for someone to learn in, they won't So we try and expose people to things as quickly as we can. So I'd expect someone that joins as an associate consultant 12 months to 18 months before they're starting to own and manage more and more of the recruitment process and starting to win and develop their own relationships. And because we place such a high emphasis on the candidate experience side of things, so we want to be famous for the experience that we provide to candidates. And that is something that we talk about on a daily, monthly, weekly, quarterly basis in all of our meetings. How are we giving people a brilliant experience? How are we supporting them through a recruitment process? And what we're seeing is the more you invest in that relationship, the more you invest in that support, actually you're starting to shorten that learning curve around business development, because these are people that at our level, we're very lucky, will be your clients. There'll be people that come back around and say, you gave me a brilliant experience. You really treated me fairly. I would like to come and ask you to find me someone. You gave me such a good experience. And that is a really great way for people to learn in a really organic but safe way.
Love it. So there's a few things that stood out to me from what you just shared. The emphasis on empathy, I think, is not that common in recruitment for some reason, even though you could make a case that that's probably one of the most important, you know, attributes of a recruitment consultant is emotional intelligence and so on. But the thing I totally resonated with as well was hiring people who are coachable, no matter how much experience they have, people who want to progress, they want to improve, they're open to feedback, and so on. Like that is, I think that's got to be one of the non-negotiables if you're hiring for your own team, is having that coachability and not someone who already thinks that they're the finished article, they know it all, and they don't need training, they don't need coaching, just leave them alone to get on with it. I don't think is going to create the culture that's going to inspire everyone to be better and to do our best. Like we have people in our coaching program who are huge billers or who have 25 years experience, or so why would someone like that join or seek coaching? Obviously, it's the mindset, having that growth mindset, always wanting to improve. And that's the sort of people who I love hanging around with. You said something I've never heard anyone in recruitment talk about, though, which is psychological safety. Could you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Happily. So I would hope or assume that kind of listeners understand the concept of psychological safety. But for me, that kind of manifests itself in multiple different ways. But it starts with the environment we're creating as a business. So I want a business where people feel it's okay that they make mistakes. I want a business where we can celebrate those mistakes and actually all gain from them and learn from them and advance as a group as a result of them. It starts from, I think, actually treating everyone as their uniquely brilliant self. Recruitment, I think, is a way to go actually in becoming more representative of society. You know, I think it's come a long way since I started in recruitment. But we are dealing with society. We're dealing with candidates and clients that are representative of all of the communities in the UK, for us as a business in the UK. And I want people to be able to join our business and feel included and feel valued and feel like they can speak up, that their voice is heard, and bring with them their ideas and their passion, because we can all learn and gain from that. So, you know, I'm very aware that I know how to do certain things, but actually there are other ways to achieve what we're doing. And we're kind of going through this conversation around our sales culture at the moment. And, you know, you've got generational differences about your willingness to pick up a phone and spend time on a phone. And I was born in an environment of you just phone. And I think, well, yeah, hold on, surely we should be doing more of that. Let's pick up the phone. Let's get our time up. But actually, if we're dealing with a client and candidate base that also don't want to be on the phone, then we're not playing to their kind of advantage and their kind of interests. And so creating a space where everyone can approach work in a way that's right for them and that fits with their kind of their beliefs, their behaviors, their passion. Recruitment is, I think, a brilliant career because anyone can do it. The barriers to entry are really, really low. And I think we've got this image of a recruiter being this really extroverted person, you know, this really confident person. And actually, some of the best recruiters I know are completely opposite to that. But what they can do is foster really incredible, deep, meaningful relationships with people very quickly. They listen, they care, and they have empathy. And I think prescribing how people approach recruitment limits that ability for uniquely brilliant people to apply their own skills in the right way. So all of that then contributes to that concept of psychological safety. So if you can't be yourself, if your natural behaviors, so we know we've just done an inclusion survey in our business. So we do it on an annual basis, and that's about the experience people have had working at Tile Hill. We're really proud of the results that come out of that. And one of the things that we always hear is people's personal values align to the values of the business, and that the behaviors we celebrate are the behaviors that come most naturally to those people. So people can come to work as themselves and feel comfortable as themselves because they are the behaviors that we celebrate and we want to see. And that might mean actually we're not the right business for some people to join. But equally, I think we can prove that actually there are very few people that have joined our business and not found it to be a place where that psychological safety and inclusion exists. So that for me is a fundamental starting point for anyone being able to grow, for anyone being able to be curious and to put themselves into a place of stress and learning.
Makes total sense. So thanks for explaining that. And I think the job is already stressful, right? And as you alluded to earlier, it's a tough job. It's not easy. There's rejection. There's disappointment. There's setbacks. There's, and everyone's going to make mistakes. So if on top of that, just this, the stress of all that, you feel like if you're going to get a mistake, you're going to get, a reprimand or made fun of or whatever it is, then that's not going to encourage people to show up and give their fulfill their full potential, right? People are going to be holding back for fear of doing something wrong. So that makes total sense. And even if you think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like safety is at the bottom. And a lot of people think of that as purely applying to a shelter, food, like in a literal sense, but it also is a psychological sense of, feeling like you're psychologically secure as well. So, and then you can ascend the ladder and, achieve your full potential there. You touched on generational differences in approaches to BD. Could you elaborate on how you've handled that as a business? Because this is an ongoing conversation I hear when we're coaching business owners who typically are somewhere between your age and my age, right? And they grew up on the phone, and that's the primary way that they get business still, and that they're hiring people into their companies and they're finding resistance and kind of that's difficult to get, other people to do in the same way that, that we did. And as you say, there are different ways of doing things, lots of different ways of getting the same result. But how do you scale if everyone's doing something different? First of all, how do you measure it? How do you scale it? And how do you know that it's going to work out and it's okay for, this person to do it one way and another person? Like, how do you manage that?
I think I'd be lying if I say we've nailed it. I know it would be. It's a constant evolution, and what works today might not work tomorrow. I'm sure many of your listeners are grappling with the use of AI in recruitment at the moment, and certainly in some of the networks that we sit in, there's these shiny objects that can completely revolutionize your approach to BD. It can put greater numbers of leads in your inbox. It can do all of these amazing things. And I think there is absolutely a role for AI in what we do. And I think that is part of a sales funnel. It's got to be around kind of how you start to add more opportunities into the top of that funnel. What you do with them from there, though, is contingent on the market you're in, the level you're at, the type of person you are. And I think it's a mixed economy of what's right for you, whether that is transacting over WhatsApp and kind of email through to whether that is picking up the phone. I personally get huge endorphins out of being in front of people. You know, the impact of COVID and how we all work now. Those weeks where I'm in the office and I'm with people on multiple days, I'm exhausted when I get the train home at the end of the week, but I'm exhilarated because I've had a different quality of conversation with people that I don't think happens if you are on a text, you know, unless you're very good at asking very insightful questions on text or WhatsApp. You're not going to get some of that additional noise. So I think the question there around performance and how you create an element of scalability and measurement, we have this debate in our leadership group of, oh, why don't we just have KPIs for the business? Why don't we just have homogenous KPIs across all fee earners and associate consultants anyway? And I don't think that necessarily is right, because what I expect of someone with 10 years recruitment experience in a mature market is very different to someone I'd expect with 5 years experience in an immature market, or someone as a consultant versus an associate director in our business. And those KPIs would need to also be reflected based on what's the problem we're trying to solve. So is the data telling us that you're great at getting jobs on, but you don't fill any of them? Because if that's the case, let's focus on what we can do to improve control. If you're not getting any jobs on, let's start to look at how you improve that ratio. How do you get more jobs into the... So let's focus on the front end activity that needs to go into that. So for me, it comes back to that understanding of what's relevant to that one person at that point in time. Comes back to the L&D program that we've got. And one of the things that we've realized is just putting people on training doesn't in its own right improve performance. It makes some difference. It's the application of that learning. And we've all been in learning sessions. We've all been in conferences where we've written loads of notes down and we're like, oh, tomorrow I'll start. And that note never gets looked at ever again. So we have mentoring conversations. So everyone that goes onto a training course has a mentor that they meet ahead of that training program, saying what they want to get out of it. And then afterwards they meet to say, what did you take from it? And what do you want me to hold you accountable to? What am I going to encourage you to do? And within all of that, there is a business development focus to it. So how are you going to go to market? I think the role of social media plays an enormous role now in the development of personal brands. I think recruiters are all marketeers in some extent. And I don't think running a webinar or a perfectly curated message on LinkedIn is going to be the silver bullet, but it all develops the story for how people will experience you and the reputation that you want to build in the market that you're in. So I think you have to be, as a recruiter now, I think you have to be really consciously purposeful in every interaction that you have and to make the most of them. And whether that is on a phone call or whether that is on a coffee meeting or even if it is just over email. But if we aren't learning and evolving that approach constantly, then we're going to find that we get left behind.
Does that mean that every person in the business has their own unique KPIs or... Okay, interesting.
So we talk about clearness being kindness. So I spoke of empathy earlier. And before people think that, you know, that's just about being soft and fluffy and kind and nice to people constantly, that is a nice byproduct of the culture that we've built, the values that we've got. But actually at the heart of that is being able to have really good quality performance conversations with people and to give them that clarity, that clearness that helps them understand where they are, where they're trying to get to and what needs to be done to change, because it's in no one's interest if you don't have that clarity and those expectations placed on you. So yes, I could say to you, well, go and do X, Y, and Z of these activities, but if that's not relevant to your position, and you know, we've had quite a few people join us, and I certainly experienced this, that you know, these homogenous KPIs that are just applied to large volumes of people, irrespective of performance or irrespective of how you are finding success, you find that people just game the system or actually just disengage from it entirely, and I don't think you get better results as from it. So I'd much rather someone sat there and goes, what is it I need to do and how does that play to my strengths? And then again, we start to get people being their unique selves. You get them to be able to play to their strengths and I think you see better results for it. And don't get me wrong, recruitment is still very much a volume-based job. You know, you need to be busy. You need to be doing the right things. But if you're doing them with purpose and you're getting the right things out of them, then actually that's more important to me than just doing things for the sake of ticking a number.
I like that. And I do agree with you. There is a counter argument, which is that, like, so totally true, depending on the level, the experience, the market that they're working in, and what their personal strengths are, they're going to have each of us needs to find our own business development formula, if you like, of blend of different strategies and approaches. Within that, though, we do know, I mean, there's strong evidence. For example, there's a platform called Sourcewell that's published studies based on the metrics of people, all the thousands of people using their platform, which is basically a tool for multi-channel outreach and organizing those types of multi-touch, multi-channel campaigns. That, first of all, you do need multiple channels, because if you're relying on just one, whether it's the phone or email or LinkedIn or what have you, then there's going to be a portion of the, you know, your target audience that you just never connect with. And secondly, though, that the if you add a phone call to an outbound cadence, you're more likely to get a meeting, for example. So then isn't it potentially doing a disservice to someone who shies away from that because it makes them uncomfortable to say, well, no, that's fine. You just do LinkedIn and webinars and you don't have to use the phone, that actually they're not going to achieve their full potential, because that is a skill set that potentially could be trained and they could build their confidence in that area.
So I think, again, it comes back to what's the problem you're trying to solve. So are you getting meetings? Cool. You're getting meetings. Crack on. You're not getting meetings. Okay. So what are you doing? So I had a conversation with someone in our team the other day that was saying, I'm really struggling to get meetings. And I said, well, tell me about your approach to it. And they said, oh, well, I send X number of emails, outreach emails to cold contacts on a weekly basis, but I'm not getting much back. And I think, I think we can look at that. I think firstly, you need to increase the number of outbound cold emails that you're sending dramatically, but what are the other touch points? So I think a lot about actually how do we nurture relationships? So recruitment is a relationship industry, and our business development, our candidate development strategy should all sit around what is it I need to do to advance this relationship to the next level? And there are all the different touch points that things like Sourcewell are built upon. But I won't shy away from the fact that actually, whilst we always need to have new leads going into the top of the funnel and we need to have some cold BD activity, statistically, I know that in our business, last year we did something like 1,500 cold BD meetings. The transition of that to placements, for 1,500 cold BD meetings, we had 27 placements. That is not a good ratio of return. That is, and that's not to say those meetings weren't worthwhile and productive, but actually I would rather our team gets the ratio right of how much time they're spending with people they already know, or the people that we already know as a business, the relationships we've already got. And that again comes back to the purpose of why candidate experience is so important, because these are people that we've got a relationship with, that we're having good touch points with. So let's invest our time there. And yeah, don't get me wrong, phone calls will always be part of recruitment. I don't want ever to kind of say that's not the case, but equally, that might not be the intervention that's needed to support someone to succeed. And that's where I think the skill of leadership in what we do in management, you know, more management than leadership, but spending time with people to understand where they are in their role, understanding what their challenges are and how you overcome them, and that growth zone that we talk about. If being on the phone is the thing that makes you kind of most nervous, you need to start eating the frog. You need to start doing that. And eventually, actually, you get more comfortable with it. We've all been through that learning curve. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we kind of have this really kind of lovely environment where people can just sort of sit on LinkedIn the whole day. If anything, actually, our strategy at the moment is to do less and less via LinkedIn.
Say more about that. Why is that the strategy?
Because I am not a massive fan of the way that LinkedIn treat recruiters. And at the moment, I don't think they actually do have a strategy that is to the benefit of recruiters. I think it's more going down the route of direct employers. And if we want to break the monopoly they hold on quite a lot of that kind of professional networking space, then I think the more we can do outside of it, the better.
Yeah, I agree 100%. We're seeing in our, with our clients a sort of movement. I mean, look, don't get me wrong. There's still the diehard, like, I must have a LinkedIn recruiter account. That's, you know, I couldn't do business otherwise. But more and more recruitment businesses are trying to find ways of connecting with clients and candidates outside of that platform. So they're not held hostage, you know, to ever increasing, you know, recruiter license fees and that kind of thing. So, I do think a lot of technology platforms that are emerging now are breaking that, that LinkedIn monopoly.
It plays to what I was saying a second ago around cold relationships versus warm. So we have a database, a full database of brilliant people. We had a period where the first place someone would go when they were resourcing a job was LinkedIn. Why are we not using these active, engaged people that we've got all of the contact details for, that know us, love us, have had an experience of us, and let's not allow that to fall out of date? So if we can get everything going through that, so yeah, there are various platforms we're using, a new e-marketing platform, Force24, which again helps us drive the integrity of that data, but improves the way, the cadence and the triggers to which we contact people within our database and kind of nurture some of those people. So again, we are never at a place of having to engage with cold contact more than we need to. We've always got a pipeline of warm, nurtured leads.
Fantastic. So I want to talk about candidate experience for most of the rest of the call, because you've highlighted that that's actually core to your business development strategy. Is a lot of candidates ultimately become clients over time, and they're the best kind, right? Because they already like you. They, you know, they've had a positive experience with you. But just since you touched on a couple of things there, do you mind sharing what is your tech stack that is working for you now in terms of like your CRM and then other kind of tools that people benefit from day to day?
Yeah, we're quite early. I'll be honest, in our journey around tech, I'd say we've been quite slow adopters. Purposefully in places, you know, actually, I don't feel the need to be a first adopter in a lot of stuff. Actually, I'd rather wait to see that it makes a difference, probably wait for it to go through that first acquisition cycle, rather than kind of going down a route and then finding we're all signing up to things via the access group. So we have a CRM of JobAdder. We have Force24, which is the e-marketing platform. We have Talent Analytics is our candidate experience or customer experience feedback platform. And that one's really important to us. That's something that we've seen huge value in. And then that's pretty much it outside of the stuff that you'd expect.
Okay, fantastic. And so what was the talent one?
Talent Analytics. It's not a mouthful normally.
Okay, that's fine. So let's talk about that. You've made candidate experience a core priority. Why have you done it? How have you done that? And what results have you seen from it?
When we first decided on this, so some of this comes back to Jim Collins. He's written a book called Good to Great, and he studied companies over a 15-year period and looked at what is the kind of the common thing that saw those companies succeed over a long term. And it was being famous for one thing and one thing only and sticking to that. So we decided very early in our journey that that was going to be customer experience and candidate experience. And when we did, and we shared that idea with people in the industry, kind of quite a few laughed at us. Quite a few of us didn't really, kind of quite a few people didn't see the commercial benefit of that. And I am really pleased to be able to now say that that's absolutely strategically, commercially been the best decision we've made. And for a whole range of reasons, it makes a difference to how we show up at work every single day, because actually I know that if I've got a team of people that are caring about the little things that make a difference to a candidate, they're absolutely going to be doing the stuff that matters to the client that pays the bill. You know, if we've got that customer centricity built into the kind of the psyche of our business, we'll get that right. Unsurprisingly, though, getting it right is about actually doing the basics brilliantly. It's not about doing amazing red carpet things. It's not about kind of those celebrity moments when you place someone and you send them a bottle of champagne. All of that stuff's really lovely and you can do it. But if you haven't treated them with respect through that process, if you haven't treated them with empathy, if you haven't supported them, then actually, you know, that's not going to change their opinion of you. And I think that then gives purpose to our teams because they enjoy the work they're doing. It doesn't feel like it's all just about the transaction. It feels about actually how do we get something, how do we support people into the jobs of their dreams, but actually advise our clients to hire the right and best people. And we can point to the fact that we've got a better understanding of our candidate network and the efficacy then of the placements that we're making. So we know that we have a really high first-time fill ratio in our permanent business and that actually the longevity of those placements is also there as well. So it's not just about the placement, it's about the right placement. And if you don't know your candidates, then I don't think you can advise your clients in the right way. At the core of that, I think it's fundamentally, it's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. And I've been placed in situations in other companies where I've been asked to do things with candidates that I don't believe in. And that has compromised my social moral compass. And that's been contributing factors to wanting to leave companies. So I think for me, if we are treating people with dignity, then I think we'll all get more out of work. I think from a business perspective, in recruitment, in any industry, you know, if you want to talk about USPs, I don't want us to compete on price.
Totally.
There's only so much innovation that we can do within some of the markets that we're in. We kind of are evolving, but I don't think we can necessarily kind of completely innovate around the way we deliver to public sector organizations. You know, there are certain constitutions and governance expectations that sit with that. So if we can't have a USP around those things, what we can have is around experience. And actually, that is our differentiator. And if you have that focus on candidate experience culturally baked in, it's not that easily replicable. You can't just decide, oh, today we're going to go and be really good to our candidates, because it won't be innate. It won't be the behaviors that are celebrated in that business. And it won't necessarily mean you've got recruiters that are focused in on that. So for us, the experience that we give people is paramount. And for me, that is also kind of one of the drivers I've got, is around raising the professional standards of the recruitment industry. I'm really passionate about recruitment as a brilliant career, as a brilliant profession, the difference it makes to people, to organizations, to society. But we're all judged by the worst experience that people have had. So we use Talent Analytics. It's a kind of a NPS-based score system. So everyone that goes into a recruitment process with us gets sent a request for feedback. Takes 1 minute, score us 0 to 10, and they will give us, we've got 86% of candidates are net promoters, so 9 or 10 out of 10.
Wow, that's astonishing.
We're very happy with that. The goal is to get above 90, but as a starting point, we're very happy. The process we've got wrapped around that, though, is it's all well and good asking for that 9 out of 10, that 10 out of 10 score that we get. But actually, how do we learn from that experience? How do we gain from that experience? So everyone that gives us feedback will be given a call, a phone call, either by me if they're a detractor. So if they're someone that's had an awful experience with us, they'll get a phone call from me to understand that. If they are passive, the person that has supported them through that process will front up to that conversation and say, look, sounds to me like you didn't think the experience was brilliant. What could I do differently? And this is not about being defensive. This is not about trying to argue our position. This is just a place of listening to say, okay, tell me what I didn't get. What did I not do well? What could I do differently? And then if you're a promoter, the manager of that person phones, and that's about what are the behaviors that we should champion and celebrate internally? What do we need to continue to embed? What I find fascinating around the detractor calls that I make, and you know, I kind of don't relish doing them at times, but they're really important. And often we're bearing the brunt of these people's experience of the recruitment industry as a whole. We just happen to be the company that's asked for that feedback. So they say, oh, we've got no issue with Tile Hill. It's just, this is the last, you know, this is the straw that broke the camel's back. And this is the fifth time this week this has happened. And But at the moment, what we're seeing in the recruitment industry and particularly the market we're in, you've got people really deeply concerned about their careers. You've got people really concerned about the availability of work. A large part of our business is an interim business, and the trends in this year's Institute of Interim Management survey are saying people are working less days, they're getting paid less, the gap between assignments is greater. And we can sit in our desk really busy, not understanding or kind of respecting the fact that these are people that, you know, we might not be able to pay their bills. Their family has got kind of demands, they've got pressures. And actually, us asking it for that feedback, Liz, it's a really positive conversation around what else can we be doing to help you? How can we support you in your career? If it's not about, you know, jobs themselves, what can we do to help you identify jobs in other places, or how do we get your CV right? So that for me is a massive driving point to our learning journey and the way that we evolve our services. The final bit I'd talk about would be the diversity of the workforce. So as we've seen in society, the growth of I suppose desire to make sure that workforces are representative of society, and particularly leadership teams, and that is no more paramount than in the public sector. You know, how can you represent a community if you don't understand it, if you haven't kind of lived it yourself? And our clients are highly, highly focused on making sure that they have diverse shortlists. I can point to the impact that having a really good candidate experience makes to the diversity of a shortlist. Because again, it comes back to treating people as their uniquely brilliant self. It comes back to making sure that we support each person to be at their best within a recruitment process. And if we can do that, then we've got a better chance of our clients selecting from a position of choice than we do from a position of weakness of the least worst option. So we can see that actually when we look at the data of the way that we treat people, increases the likelihood they're going to want to apply for a job via Tile Hill, which makes a difference to our clients in the starting point. And we've also got evidence from testimonials that get sent to me, emails that I receive where people have said, had it not been for the way that I was treated, I'd have dropped out of this process. And particularly when you start looking at the kind of characteristics of that person, then you start to realize there's a disproportionate number of people that actually are not from the majority, that sit in a different space, and being able to keep them in that process is what our clients are after. So we are doing the right thing by our client by focusing in on the candidate experience.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that. And this has been super interesting. And you've shared several, which was the premise of my original line of inquiry, which is you guys have won all these awards. You know, what sits behind that? And you shared a lot of things that you guys at Tile Hill are getting extremely right. What I'd love to learn from you is, so a lot of my clients, as well as people listening, will be entrepreneurs who are trying to scale a business. And it's challenging, right? It's not, if it was easy, everyone would be super successful at it, right? But we know that it's the minority of companies that do manage to grow past, you know, a handful of original, like the founder and a sort of small team. What's been the most difficult or challenging aspect of your journey over the last 8 years to get to the point you are today?
I'd argue the risk of where we are right now is the biggest challenge that we'll have to overcome, notwithstanding the economy and the kind of the recruitment market more broadly. But we are at a place and a size now where actually the risk is you start to try and protect what you've built. You start to protect the way you do things, and you become deeply entrenched in just this is the way we do things. And all it takes is for another company to come along that's agitating the market to spot an opportunity and to quite quickly chip away at what you've built. And there is no reason why we at our size cannot continue to have that innovation, that curiosity, that desire to actually question, are we doing things in the right way, the best way? Are we looking at where opportunities lie? So I think the biggest risk is complacency. The larger we get, the more awards we win, the higher the standards people expect of us internally and externally. You know, when we're out there saying we want to be famous for the experience that we give people, we're held to a really high standard, and you do it once, you have to do it again, and you have to do it better. You can't just do it the same. So I think the risk for us and the kind of the challenge for us to lead through now is actually sometimes we need to dismantle what we've built to move forwards. We need to be comfortable to lead through that change. And that might mean that we have to kind of challenge some sort of sacred conceptions in our business. So for me, that's a kind of the excitement of leadership through this, but it is a real risk and it is a real challenge.
If I can just ask about this, Anthony. So look, totally agree. Complacency is the enemy, right? And it can be a byproduct of success. You achieve success doing things a certain way, and then you become complacent. You stop innovating, challenging, and so on. But that strikes me as a much nicer challenge, or a much more interesting challenge to combat, rather than like, how am I going to make payroll? We've had a like disastrous month, or we're trying to the original like core people in the business are trying to bill and hire and train and do the bookkeeping and the credit control and the marketing and everything else. Like, so I'm just thinking back to some of the growing pains you've experienced. What is there a particular thing that stands out in your mind as like a real difficult stage in the business, and then how did you navigate out of that?
Whether we put this in, Mark, I don't know, but
okay.
And I don't mean to seem flippant or like life's just been rosy constantly. We haven't faced some of those significant challenges and pressures. We've always been, and I can't attest to this because Dave, who founded the company, 18 months of setting things up prior to me joining with him, and definitely some growing pains in that period, how you get the infrastructure you need to be able to move forward. So financing arrangements, how you start to hire people to an unknown brand, an unknown entity. I think for us, those early days were clearly challenging, and Dave would tell you stories of having to run the payroll for our interims in a tent in a thunderstorm in France with very limited internet connection.
Right.
But actually, kind of as we've grown, we've been very careful and structured in how we've dealt with money. We always make sure we leave plenty of cash in the business. We are very hot on credit control, and one of the upsides of being again working with the public sector is typically payment times are okay. We have relatively low percentages of bad debt. We'd love them to pay us a bit faster, but generally that's been okay. I think for me the current or the last 18 months has been our expansion out of what would be our core markets. So we're best known in local government, and we're very successful within that, but we don't want to just work in local government. We want to support the careers of people across the broader public sector, and that's to help them navigate between different parts of it. And to do that, we need to be present in all of the markets I mentioned to you earlier. And we've not always got it right. We've hired people to set up new areas for us that we haven't managed to land successfully, and I think probably in places we've given it longer than we should have done for that hope of success. We've always hired very strongly on values. So for me, values and mindset are the things that I will hire on more so than track record and background. And as a result of that, I would like to hope we've dodged making that many or too many bad hires, and our turnover is very low. Which actually is probably part of the reason for our success. It probably runs at 3-5% maximum turnover on an annual basis. And so we've been able to grow and nurture people. And that organic growth, again, has been really kind of central to our ability to grow without too many aches and pains. So I don't know if that's answered your question, Mark. I don't know if it's a bit of a cop-out. But we've relatively plain sailing to date.
Yeah. It sounds like you and Dave both highly experienced, and you've really taken an intelligent approach to building and growing this business, and you've been able to do that very, very successfully. What about in terms of like the market itself, forces you can't control, whether that's budget cutbacks or, you know, changes in government, which are going to have a ripple effect on, you know, downstream and that kind of thing? Like, how have you been able to bounce back from any challenges in that regard?
So I'd say that the last 2 years, yeah, has definitely been an element of that. So again, one of the upsides of the public sector is it will always exist in some capacity. I remember the day that the first lockdown for COVID was announced, and I was in Birmingham. I'd just got on the train. I'd just concluded the appointment to a position, and the momentum in the business was great. And I was like, we're great. And then you look at the news and you go, wow, okay, the world's changed and our business is going to fall apart. We've got X number of interims that are out working for us, driving revenue growth in our business, and suddenly they're going to be turned off because they're not going to be needed. And in that moment, I could see it all coming down in front of us. But actually, the opposite happened. We were really, really lucky. The interims that we had working for us were redeployed onto all sorts of initiatives, because these are people that are dealing in community-based organizations, councils. So they were at the forefront of dealing with the pandemic and the humanitarian aid that went around it. And so actually we had an opportunity in that we seized. And Dave and I both were very strong in our conviction that we would do what's right for the business before we'd do something for ourselves. And at that time, I can't remember exactly how many people that we employed, maybe 10 or 12. But we always maintained that we would make sure they got paid before we got paid. And it was about that time we started to see some of the behaviors and the ethical practices of other companies in our space start to come to the fore. So we took the brave decision to hire quite strongly in that period. You know, we didn't have huge visibility of how long the pandemic would last, or when kind of permanent recruitment would kick back in, or what would happen. But we thought, actually, if we can use this as a time to get really great people, then we should. And so we were really lucky. We hired amazing people that have absolutely gone on to do brilliant things since they joined. And that fundamental belief in doing the right thing, integrity is one of our values. And that was one of the calling cards that led people join us and why they did. And then now, you know, we're in a market where the public sector exists. It's not got huge amounts of disposable income. You know, austerity and kind of the financial headroom that kind of we're talking about with the Chancellor and tax rises that need to happen. We're going to have a spending review that probably means less money going to each element of the public sector. And that's putting huge pressure on kind of recruitment. But I don't need the recruitment market to grow. I just need to take more of it from our competitors. I need us to build relationships so that when the market does grow, when those opportunities do come up, we're the first people that get that phone call. And that then comes back to that empathy, spending time with people in a way that they want to be spent time with, understanding what's important to them. Because again, that whole thing around customer centricity for me is when we're recruiting for a person, we're also making a difference to their career. You know, if we're surrounding with the right people, then they are going to look good on their journey. They are going to go where they need to get to. So it's not just about a bum on a seat. It's about how that recruitment exercise matters to that person. And if we're treating every single interaction we have with someone as how can we support you to advance your career, then actually we're doing the right thing by them. And I think they're more likely to come back to us when the times are that they need to recruit. And in a tricky market, that's what you need. You need people that are kind of loyal to you, that want to work with you and that call you when those opportunities arise. So I'm not saying we're getting it all right. I'm not saying we're growing in every area that we want to be, but with a really robust focus on relationships, we're kind of managing through some of that. We've made some relatively bold decisions. So in our interim business, there's a massive drive to work via managed vendors, so MSPs. That strategically is not how we want to operate with our clients. And we are under constant pressure from our teams in places, but definitely from our clients to sign up and work via those. And that is the right thing for some businesses. I'm not going to take that away from those that choose to work through that, because I think that works for them. But for us, that's a move that we've made really clear that we do not want to work in those channels. And that might mean we lose the odd battle. But over the course of time, I think that's the right way for us to deal with our clients and to position ourselves to be that strategic partner that they want and to be an improvement partner alongside them.
I agree 100%. Anthony, you're really good at reframing challenges into opportunities and looking for, you know, looking at things in a certain light that creates confidence and, you know, in moving forward. So I admire that. And especially like your answer that even if the market overall, the recruitment market doesn't grow, if we're better than our competitors and we're able to take business away from them, then we can still grow as a business. And then the relationships we formed when the pie does get better, get bigger, then we'll grow in that dimension as well. So there's so much we could talk about, Anthony, but we're out of time today. That was fun. Hope you enjoyed it as well.
Thank you for having me. No, it's great. It's always good to think some of these things through and talk them about. So yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, have an awesome rest of your day, and I'll look forward to catching up with you again in the future. Thanks, Anthony.
Great stuff. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. I know how busy recruiters are, so I'm honored that you're investing this time with me each week. I don't take your attention for granted. That's why I'm going all out to deliver value for you here, real insights you can apply to improve your business. And if you really want to help me to reach a wider audience and impact more people, please consider leaving the show a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave me a review, please reach out and let me know so I can thank you personally. Please hit the subscribe button, and I'll see you next time.